because he was dropping in the polls, or because he wanted to divert from the Epstein files, or because he didn't get the Nobel Peace Prize. But, you know, it is a foundational principle here that the president cannot just decide to go to war. He can do it in an emergency. And that's why the Constitution says, doesn't say that only the Congress can make war, because they allow the president in a case of an emergency, but not to declare war and keep a war going.
We have 10 seconds. President Trump now told The Atlantic magazine they want to talk, and I've agreed to talk, so I'll be talking to them. As the U.S. and Israel strikes Iran hundreds of times, and apparently the Pentagon, the president is saying this will go on for weeks.
Well, you know, I mean, we're shifting. I mean, this shows that there was no plan here. The whole reason, I mean, one of the main reasons to have this constitutional provision is so that a war can be deliberated, so you understand what a war is about. You go to the people, you go to the Congress,
deliberate,
and you decide as a nation there should be a war or there shouldn't be.
Reed Brody, war crimes prosecutor, member of the International Commission of Jurists. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations of programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Program Advisory Committee meets quarterly on the first Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
and you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, having some technical problems, but we are back stronger than ever. And we are from Pacifica Radio. Today on the show, Pink Notes, our weekly collaboration with Code Pink. We'll be joined by Pink Notes co-host Cynthia Papermaster and special guest retired Colonel Ann Wright, just back from a Code Pink visit to Cuba and Venezuela. She's got a lot to say about that visit. Also, we rebroadcast the weekly edition of the Electronic Intifada Frontline Newscast with Nora Barrows Friedman. Poet Anita Barrows joins us to document the Gaza genocide in poetry, A Day at a Time. And we share a poignant letter from Kevin Cooper on death row, who remembers in a very special way the late and great Jesse Jackson, who acted to save Kevin's life. Stay with us. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Running late, we begin with our weekly segment, Pink Notes, with our co-host from Code Pink, Cynthia Papermaster. Cynthia, we are joined by Colonel Ann Wright, retired, at a very crucial time. She's just back from a visit to Venezuela and Cuba. You want to bring her in and give us a little sense of what's going on with Code Pink on the ground there.
Yes, thank you, Dennis. I'm going to give you a brief introduction about Anne before we have her come on with us, if you don't mind, just for a moment. I know Anne as a tireless activist. She travels the country and the world to promote peace and justice everywhere. Here's a little bit about her. She's a 29-year U.S. Army veteran who retired as a colonel, and she's a former U.S. diplomat. And she resigned in March 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq. As a diplomat, she served in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, Sierra Leone, Micronesia, and Mongolia. And in 2001, she was on a small team that reopened the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. She served as a member of the Code Pink Board of Directors, and she's an advisory board member of Veterans for Peace, International Peace Bureau, World Beyond War, Gaza Freedom Flotilla, No to NATO, Hawaii Peace and Justice, Pacific Peace Network, and Women Cross the DNC. So, Anne, welcome so much for joining us today on Pink Notes. I'm really, really happy that you're here. And you just returned from a trip to Venezuela. And I wonder if you could tell us about that humanitarian delegation, peace delegation to Venezuela. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Cynthia and Dennis. It's a pleasure to be with you all. And as you mentioned, I've just come back last night from Venezuela. We were there 4 days as a part of a Code Pink delegation of 19 people, 17 from the U.S., one from Brazil, and one from Colombia. We met with government officials. We met with civil organizations, and we met with just people on the street. And The bottom line is, of course, they are horrified about what the United States did in the abduction, the kidnapping of the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores, who Celia herself had been president of the National Assembly and a minister of justice of the country of Venezuela. So the country is, as I think, as we in the United States are disturbed about yet one more criminal act that our country has done, which is the kidnapping of a head of state and bringing that person and his wife to the United States to go on trial for alleged drug dealings. It'll be very interesting to hear from the court what all is alleged, although already the indictment against President Maduro has been edited to eliminate some of the initial things that were in the indictment. Bottom line, though, is that people are very disturbed about the U.S. taking military action. They want peace. They don't want to have a confrontation with the United States, even though the last many years since the Hugo Chavez administration, the United States has been putting extraordinary sanctions on the country, making it difficult for people to live. And there has been a migration out of Venezuela as things get tougher and tougher there because of U.S. Sanctions that have been put on the country. And now that the U.S. has nominally kind of taken over at least the oil industry, the people are very concerned about what is the U.S. going to steal all of the resources of Venezuela under the cover of the kidnapping of the head of state, and all of that's yet to be determined.
All right. Well, talk a little bit now about this was a violent attack on Venezuela. Over 100 Venezuelans died. Could you describe the violence that took place and the kinds of destruction that the United States left in the face of this illegal international kidnapping of a president of a country?
Yes, indeed. We went to the commune, the large neighborhood that was right close to where the presidential residence was, where they took President Maduro and Celia Flores. And the description by people that live in that area of what happened was, was graphic and chilling. And as the people there, so we've still got PTSD from hearing all of the explosions that happened, of having electricity blown out, having windows blown out by the force of the explosions, hearing all of the gunfire from the F-16s, the bombs that were dropping from the F-16s, the gunfire coming from various helicopters that were coming in at very, very low level. And in fact, the president, President Trump, at the State of the Union on Tuesday, gave the Medal of Honor to one of the helicopter pilots who took in part of the Delta Force. The helicopter pilot was shot while they were bringing in the helicopter. And that was the first time that we have really heard anything about whether or not any U.S. military were injured. But the 100 or more Venezuelans that were killed by the U.S. forces in the abduction, plus the 32 Cuban military that were there, it was a violent scene. And in order to get into that place, they were knocking out communications equipment all over that part of Caracas. And we did visit an Institute for Scientific Investigations, which is a long name for an educational facility up on top of one of the hills. And the communications facility was knocked out, and debris damaged lots of buildings that were in that scientific area, to include a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactor is for making medical isotopes, but it does have a large pool of radioactive waste that is in that facility. And it was just right down the hill from where the U.S. blew up this communications facility. And they were just, the world is lucky that none of the debris severely damaged that building. However, there were other buildings that were holding medical equipment, dialysis equipment, that were destroyed. So the types of destruction that was going on kind of the cover for the ability to go in and kidnap Nicolas Maduro was substantial. And it has given the people of Venezuela an eerie feeling about, the throwbacks to what the U.S. has done in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and the level of destruction that the U.S. is capable of, which the Venezuelans say, we don't want that. I mean, you are not our enemy. We'd like to be friends with you if indeed you could get your governments to actually treat us with respect and acknowledge that we are a sovereign country and that we have to work out issues, but they shouldn't be at the point of a gun.
If there was an attack like the attack that the United States conducted in Venezuela against the United States, what do you think the response would be? What kind of violations, what kind of laws have been broken? This is a war crime, a multiple with multiple deaths, right? How do we move forward in terms of diplomacy here?
Well, that's tough, although to the credit of the administration, which was sworn in, the vice president of the country, Dulce Rodriguez, at the order of succession, when the president is out, the vice president was sworn in by the Constitutional Court, and no cabinet ministers resigned. There was no argument about who was going to lead the country. So she's been leading it and has projected a sense of calm throughout the whole country. However, there, you know, a lot of Venezuelans are saying, well, why are you meeting with like the head of the CIA, the head of the U.S. Southern Command, the head of the Secretary of Energy for the United States, which she has done. But in the ability of trying to keep a calmness, I acknowledge that the United States had several different plans going. One of them was the abduction of the president. The other one was an abduction plus a huge amount of destruction of facilities. And one of the things that that we got from everyone is that they want peace. They don't want more violence to occur, and they want to be treated with respect and acknowledgement that they are an independent country and should be treated as such. So despite all of the criminal acts that the U.S. government did on the people of Venezuela, they told us as American citizens that we don't hate you, but we certainly don't like what your government is doing.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have the honor of being joined by Colonel Ann Wright, retired former U.S. Army Reserve in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps for many years. Also joining us is our pink, Code Pink co-host, Cynthia. Join us.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you, Ann, so much. I don't know how you keep going. You're amazing. Your energy is just amazing. Thank you. So I'd like to give people a heads up that this tax day coming up on April 15, we're going to be organizing events around the country to say we don't want our taxes spent on attacks on sovereign countries such as Venezuela. We don't want our taxes spent on a genocide being carried out by Israel with its partner, the United States, in Palestine. And I'm just giving people a heads up to think about joining together with all the groups, Taxpayers Against Genocide, Code Pink, Palestinian Youth Movement, et cetera. We're going to be doing actions on April 15th. So thank you for letting me announce that.
And before we let you go, Anne, where do you go next? What do you think the mission should be for Code Pink? What do you think the mission should be for the American people and the future of... is it possible to rescue, or are we heading hell-bent into something that looks awfully like fascism?
Well, I think we are in a movement toward fascism, which we all have to push back against. And there certainly have been lots of instances of that. In the last 2 weeks, I've also been up to Minneapolis, where citizens there are challenging ICE in such dramatic ways and paying a price for it. But they're doing it. Also, I wanted to mention, I've just come back from Cuba. And I was there right after the January 3rd U.S. Kidnapping at Nicolas Maduro. And as you can well imagine, the people in Cuba who have been under U.S. sanctions for nearly almost 70 years now, and with the lack of fuel, because Venezuela normally would send fuel to Cuba, and that's been cut off by the U.S., it's been, people are scared that the U.S. may do to Cuba what they did to Venezuela. And the effects of all of the sanctions the U.S. has had on Cuba was really, really dramatic. The last time I was there was a year before, and the number of electrical blackouts that were happening, the lack of fuel for cars, and not that everybody has a car in Cuba, that's for sure, but it was a noticeable downturn in everything. And then to add on to it, the fact that another head of state in a neighboring area had just been abducted. As you mentioned, what can we do about it? Well, Code Pink Women for Peace and Progressive International and a few other organizations are organizing a caravan to Cuba that will be at March 20th through 23rd, and it will be by air and sea. We hope to have some boats leaving from one of the countries surrounding Cuba, as well as flights that will be coming in from the U.S. and from other parts of the world to be there in solidarity with the people of Cuba, saying we are not forgetting you.
Well, we appreciate you, Code Pink, and our special segment on Thursday. Thank you, Cynthia Papermaster. Appreciate you. Final 30 seconds. Anything you want to squeeze in here, Cynthia? Go for it.
Sure. I want people to go to codepink.org, our website. Take a look at the events calendar. See what's happening near you. Join with Code Pink. We are a feminist grassroots organization. We're constantly working for peace and justice. And thank you, Dennis, for hosting Code Pink Notes.
You're so welcome, and we'll talk to you next week. We thank the both of you. You are heroes in the eyes of our listeners, and we will be back soon. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's KPFA in the Bay Area, a network founded in 1949 by folks who understood how important it was to have a free speech, non-fretted, no-holds-barred, truth-to-power radio station network, the People's Radio Network. More coming up. And guess what? I'm going to tell you right now, we have a special segment, a very moving segment coming up from Kevin Cooper on Death Row. Kevin is going to tell us about his relationship with Jesse Jackson and how Jesse Jackson played a role on saving his life, Kevin's life, while he's on death row, where he still is. Listen to this.
I'm Kevin Cooper, and I'm still on death row in the state of California here in the year 2026. In 2004, on February the 10th, at 1 minute after midnight, the state of California was planning to torture and murder me via poisonous lethal injection drugs. However, at 11 a.m. on February the 9th, the late Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. came to San Quentin Prison with one of my attorneys, the late Junie Arn Sternberg, and brought me the stay of execution paperwork from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This wasn't over because the United States Supreme Court could still overturn the stay. But for then, at that time, I was happy. From 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., Reverend Jackson stayed with me and with my other visitors in the visiting room. He did everything he could to take my mind off the fact that I could still be executed if the Supreme Court lifted the stay of execution. He told jokes to make me laugh. He prayed with me, and he prayed for me. He made me cry, and he made me think. He did everything he could to show me that I was important to him. He told me stories about the struggles that we black people have in this criminal justice system, and that the death penalty was no more than a modern day lynching. He told me that we had to have faith that one day we would put an end to this death penalty, and I believed him. I really did. I believed him then, and I still believe that now. At 6 o'clock p.m., I was taken to the death chamber waiting room, but I was not executed that night. The stay of execution held that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals granted me. I thanked him then, and I thank him now, for his kindness, for his humanity, and for his caring for everyday people like me. May he rest in peace, and may he rest in power. In struggle and solidarity from death row, I'm Kevin Cooper.
Kevin Cooper from death row. We are watching Kevin and what goes on there for many years. Death row, U.S. prison system, deadly already, even when the liberals are in control. Right now, the U.S. prison system is a killer. And we'll have an open mic anytime for Kevin Cooper. And we thank that sharing, which tells us a lot also about who Jesse Jackson is, who he was. We just lost him. But a beautiful, beautiful story. You are listening to Flashpoints. We're now going to broadcast for you the very powerful Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman.
This is the Electronic Intifada Newscast. I'm Nora Barros Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 874 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip 4.5 months into the fraudulent ceasefire, while adequate and dignified shelter materials, food supplies, and medications continue to be blockaded by Israel and its Western partners. Heavy rains once again hit Gaza this week, flooding thousands of tents and leaving families without proper protection from the elements. Two Palestinians were killed on Wednesday evening in eastern Deir al-Balah in central Gaza in an Israeli attack that targeted civilians, according to medical sources at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. On Tuesday, a Palestinian was killed in an Israeli drone attack in Gaza City, according to the Wafa news agency. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza says that as of February 25th, 618 Palestinians have been killed and more than 1,600 injured since the so-called ceasefire agreement went into effect last October. Writing in Middle East Eye this week, journalist and researcher Maha Husseini reports that, quote, despite the relative lull in large-scale bombardment, attacks have not fully ceased. On the first 2 days of Ramadan, the Israeli military killed 2 Palestinians and injured 4 others across the Gaza Strip. Husseini adds that since 2023, Palestinians in Gaza have observed Ramadan under Israeli-imposed starvation, quote, during which Israeli forces killed hundreds of Palestinians waiting for aid in Gaza City in what was dubbed the Flower Massacres. This Ramadan, she says, Gaza's markets resemble the pre-war period, with shelves once again stocked with goods. Quote, yet for many in Gaza, those items remain largely out of reach, unaffordable amid the near total devastation of the impoverished strip's economic sector. Many families are forced to spend their days filling water and collecting firewood to heat their tent shelters and prepare food. By the end of January, only about 20% of the allotted 1,500 trucks of cooking gas have entered Gaza, Husseini notes, so families are dependent on dwindling amounts of firewood to cook during Ramadan. Israel is continuing to deny medical evacuations to children and adult patients alike after nearly 2.5 years of genocide and the destruction of the health system across Gaza. And while Israel continues to block necessary medications, medical equipment, and supplies to repair vital health infrastructure from entry. On February 22nd, 2-year-old Nidal Abu Rabi died after waiting for treatment for a disease that affected his liver and spleen. Reporter Asama Kahlout recorded Nidal's mother, Iman Hamdoun, in shock and grief, holding her son's little body that was wrapped in blankets. She says that the evacuation referral for Nidal had been in place for 3 months, but Israel kept denying him permission to leave Gaza for medical treatment. Quote, my voice is gone from the amount of appeals I made, she says. No one cares about me or about the child. Today I lost my son. I don't want to lose my daughter too. Iman says that her daughter is receiving treatment at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital for kidney disease and has low protein and albumin levels, and that every time she is admitted, her situation is difficult and she's put on oxygen.
The World Health Organization said last month that more than 18,500 people in the Gaza Strip, including at least 4,000 children, still require evacuation for medical treatment unavailable in the territory. The Gaza Ministry of Health said on February 2nd that more than 1,200 patients have already died while waiting to leave for urgent medical treatment. New evidence has been released this week in a 73-page report by the independent investigative research organizations Forensic Architecture and Earshot into the massacre of 15 Palestinian rescue workers in Tal el-Sultan in southern Gaza nearly a year ago on March 23, 2025. In the attack, as you may remember, Israel killed 8 aid and rescue workers with the Palestine Red Crescent Society, 6 from the Palestinian Civil Defense, and a staff member of UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees. The Israeli military was forced to change its story about the ambush several times following the discovery of the bodies in a mass grave, along with their flattened vehicles, and the emergence of video and audio recordings taken by the rescue workers, reports Dropsite News. An internal military inquiry ultimately did not recommend any criminal action against the army units responsible for the attack. Earshot and Forensic Architecture's investigation, their report says, quote, offers detailed evidence regarding the circumstances of the incident in Tal el-Sultan, including extrajudicial executions, a survivor being forced to work at an Israeli military checkpoint, and efforts to conceal, disturb, and erase evidence relating to the attack. Some of the findings included in the report reveal that Israeli soldiers, quote, ambushed and subjected Palestinian aid workers to a near continuous assault for over 2 hours, even though the soldiers never came under fire, and that, quote, at least 910 gunshots were documented across 3 video and audio recordings of the attack. The vast majority of these gunshots, at least 844, were fired over just 5 minutes and 30 seconds. At least 93% of the gunshots recorded in the first minutes of the attack were fired directly towards the emergency vehicles and aid workers by Israeli soldiers, the report adds. And during this time, at least 5 shooters fired simultaneously. Witness testimonies suggest as many as 30 soldiers were present in the area. Furthermore, Israeli soldiers, quote, first maintained fixed firing positions from the elevated sandbank, then walked toward the aid workers while continuing to shoot. Upon reaching the aid workers, the soldiers moved between them and the vehicles and executed some of the aid workers at point-blank range, as close as 1 meter away, Dropsite notes. In the 37 days following the attack, one of the 2 survivors was detained without charge, tortured, and interrogated in relation to the incident at the Sidi Tayman detention camp. And in the days and weeks that followed, the area surrounding the site of the massacre was further transformed by the Israeli military's construction of the so-called Morag Corridor and the building of an aid distribution site operated by the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, the report explains. Speaking to Dropsite, former UN official in Palestine Jonathan Whittall, who was one of the team members on the ground when the mass grave was discovered 5 days after the attack, and who provided evidence to Forensic Architecture and Earshot for their investigation, said, quote, following our discovery of the mass grave, the narrative from Israeli forces shifted multiple times. We were fed several versions of a blatant lie. The men we retrieved last year were medics. We found them in their uniforms, ready to save lives, only to be killed by Israeli forces, fully aware of their protected status. This illustrates an abhorrent disregard for international law, he continued, where any Palestinian in an Israeli-designated evacuation zone is targeted regardless of their civilian status. It highlights the total lack of accountability under which these forces operate. International governments continue to arm and trade with a leadership accused of genocide, whose soldiers massacred medics and buried them in a grave marked by the siren light of the ambulance they destroyed, Whittall said. On Tuesday, the British Palestine Committee hosted a launch event for the new report in the UK Parliament. In addition to providing the findings of the report, researchers included evidence that a British reconnaissance plane flew over the site of the massacre only 2 days following the killings. The committee and the research groups are demanding that the UK government, quote, reveal any footage taken during that flight, as it may contain evidence crucial for bringing the perpetrators of the massacre to justice for their crimes under international criminal law. Speakers warned that failure to do so may amount to obstruction of justice. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli soldiers and settlers shot and killed two Palestinian teenagers this week. In the early morning hours of Sunday, February 22nd, Israeli forces killed a 17-year-old Palestinian boy in the northern town of Beit Furik. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Mohammed Wahbi Abdulaziz Hanani had just finished evening prayers in the Zalmut Mosque on Saturday evening when Israeli forces in heavily armored military vehicles arrived in the area. Mohammed and other young Palestinians allegedly threw stones toward the military vehicles for about 2 minutes before Israeli forces opened fire, striking Mohammed in the head from a distance of about 40 meters. The children's rights group reported that, quote, soldiers rushed toward Mohammed, who had collapsed on the ground, and searched the area before an Israeli military ambulance arrived and its military paramedics began to administer first aid. A few minutes later, a Palestinian ambulance arrived at the scene, and Israeli soldiers obstructed the paramedics' access to Mohammed. After several minutes of discussion, the Israeli soldiers allowed the Palestinian paramedics to provide first aid under their supervision. The Palestinian ambulance transported Mohammed to the Rafidia governmental hospital in Nablus. On the way, it encountered a closed military checkpoint, delaying the trip by several minutes. Mohammed's heart stopped in the ambulance and paramedics conducted cardiopulmonary resuscitation until they reached the hospital, where doctors in the operating room cleaned the wound and tried to stop the bleeding, but he was pronounced dead just after midnight. Mohammed is the fourth Palestinian child killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank in 2026, according to documentation collected by DCIP. Israeli forces and settlers killed 56 Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank in 2025. On February 20th, Israeli settlers shot and killed 19-year-old Nasrallah Abu Siyam in the village of Mukhmas. The armed settlers invaded the village and attacked a farmer. Abu Siyam and other residents intervened to defend the farmer, and Israeli forces then arrived and shot tear gas, sound grenades, and live ammunition. A resident of the village, speaking to the Associated Press, said that, quote, when the settlers saw the army, they were encouraged and started shooting live bullets. He added that the settlers clubbed those already injured with sticks after they had fallen to the ground. Abu Siyam was a U.S. citizen born in Philadelphia. His family has demanded accountability for his killing, while the U.S. State Department told reporters that it was, quote, carefully monitoring the situation. Elsewhere in the West Bank, Israeli settlers torched and desecrated a mosque in the village of Tel, southwest of Nablus, on February 23rd. Settlers sprayed racist graffiti on the walls of the Abu Bakr as-Siddiq Mosque, including slogans such as price tag and revenge. Other settler attacks were reported in Susia, Masafer Yatta, Jerusalem, and in Jalud near Nablus. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Noor's short life of unimaginable suffering by Sumaya Nassar, a teacher writing from Gaza. When the genocide on Gaza began, my daughter Noor was not yet 3 months in my womb, Nassar writes. Quote, I carried her inside me while living the bitterness of displacement and the cruelty of war. She was born in April 2024 under the harshest of conditions, amid a suffocating siege. She became the hope that kept me alive. I named her Noor, which means light, so she could guide me through the darkness surrounding Gaza. In mid-September, my family and I fled to a house in Deir al-Balah. I hoped we would finally be safe in an area the Israeli occupation had declared a, quote, safe zone. On the morning of September 23rd, 2025, I woke early, dressed my daughter, gently combed her soft hair, and prepared her to meet her grandparents who had arrived from Gaza City at midnight. Then a violent explosion shook the entire place. I didn't look for anything except Noor. I screamed her name again and again. Then I suddenly heard her father yelling, "Help! Noor, quick!" We found her lying on the ground. She had fallen from the third floor all the way down to the lower level when the upper floor was bombed. Still, unmoving, no trace of blood, I screamed. My husband and I were terrified to even touch her. Our hands froze above her tiny body. Her uncle, Mohammed, 22, gently placed his hand over her heart and felt a faint heartbeat. He looked at us calmly and said, "She's still alive." My husband ran outside without realizing he had no shoes on, searching desperately for any means of transport. He saw our neighbor getting into his car, heading to the market, and begged him to take them to the hospital. My husband tried to pick up Noor, but he couldn't. His hands were trembling uncontrollably, and fear had numbed his entire body. So Mohammed carried her gently and placed her in the car. I went with them to the hospital. When the doctor saw her, he looked at me with a silence that spoke plenty, as if he were saying, "There's nothing we can do. You may lose her." She was rushed into the intensive care unit. She was the only child in the unit at Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir Abala. She lay on the bed showing no signs of life. Her small body was covered in tubes and surrounded by machines. Long visits were forbidden. I was only allowed 10 minutes a day. I would place my hand on her tiny body and find it as cold as ice. My heart shattered again and again. She had internal bleeding, doctors said. Her skull was fractured from the fall. Every minute I prayed that her bleeding would stop, that she would survive. After 12 long days in the ICU, my beloved girl finally emerged from the critical stage and was moved to the pediatric ward. She survived, but at what cost? The head injury and what doctors said was bleeding in her brain caused Noor to lose her sight and her ability to move. After a long period in the hospital where doctors were unable to offer the treatment my daughter needed, I had no choice but to return with her to a tent in a displacement camp in Deir Abala where we had found shelter. I stand helpless before her suffering. I cannot restore her vision. I cannot help her walk or play with other children. She cries constantly, out of pain, boredom, and confusion. Every few seconds, she calls out, "Mama," just to make sure I'm beside her. She clings to me, believing that I can protect her, even from Israeli airstrikes. Those are excerpts from Noor's Short Life of Unimaginable Suffering by Sumaya Nassar, a teacher, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and reclamation across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, photographer Khamis Al-Refi captured images of Palestinians performing the first Taraweeh prayer of Ramadan on the ruins of the great Omari Mosque in Gaza City, built in the 7th century and largely destroyed in Israeli attacks during the first few months of the genocide. And this past week, young singer Mohammed Al-Shabraoui walked down the streets with his friends, singing a song about the pride and dignity of Gaza. The lyrics are, quote, "For your sake, your people stand noble. Oh, our steadfast Gaza, there's no way that Israel can take Gaza. The people of Gaza declared it. For your sake, the siege will be lifted. With you, we die with our heads held high. We will come out from beneath the wall. The people of Gaza declared it." كرمالك الشعب القاصر يا غزتنا الأبية فشرت فشرت إسرائيل كهلوها الغزاوية كرمالك يعلى الحصار ومعاكي من موت كبار من حق من تحت الجدار كهلوها الغزاوية. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Let's bring into the conversation Miguel Gavilan Molina. We're going to be talking about what's going on with ICE in the Bay Area. And also Francisco Herrera, I believe, is joining us now. Gavilan, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dennis. And there's... You know, there's just an air of uncertainty. The communities this side of the U.S.-Mexican border, particularly in the Bay Area here throughout the region, there's a lot of tension. What's occurring in Mexico down in the state of Michoacán is having ripple effects up here. And I think that's one thing we'll get into talking about, Dennis, with Francisco.
Okay, Francisco Herrera, are you with us?
I'm right here with you. Thank you so much.
Terrific. It's great to have you with us. Sorry for all the distractions, but I believe we got this going now. Francisco, one of the things that you've been working on is what's happening in terms of the communities of color in the Bay Area and the kinds of tensions and dangers and fear that's now rippling through the communities in the Bay Area and throughout California. Could you talk a little bit about the kind of work that you've been doing and things that you've been encountering in this new world order of ICE threatening so many people?
Hey, well, it sounds like a very old world order, like a medieval kind of a Dark Ages world order. Our members are day laborers, domestic workers, folks with very, very limited income who are making ends meet, who actually provide up to $70 billion in taxes to the United States and another $80 billion to their home countries, particularly Mexico. Central America is what I'm thinking about. Are really feeling the brunt of all of this violence in terms of the U.S. narco-terrorism project, which, of course, we all know started with President Nixon when he started his drug war on people, but it's continued through Reagan, through Bush, and even through Obama and Biden. Why make it like it's just been a Republican thing? Anyway, our people are feeling it. I mean, yes, Sunday afternoon, I started getting texts from all kinds of folks in the community here in the Bay Area whose relatives were experiencing the burnt cars. One young man who had his, they were traveling from doing music in Mexico City were stopped, and their whole truckload of instruments and everything, they were pulled off of their trucks, and their truck with all their instruments and equipment with which they make their livelihood with was burned on the road. You know, another family of a member of our Latino task force team here from San Juan de los Lagos in Jalisco were out shopping, and all of them were stopped at right point blank in the street with firearms, and all of their cars were burned. And so people are here feeling the terrorism that the U.S. has financed, of course, through this fake blaming of or creating this phony drug thing that we benefit from here, because all the drugs come to the United States and Europe, you know. So anyway, our people are feeling the whole violence that's happening, and it's not like some foreign distant cousin or some general people. It's, folks are feeling it because their friends and neighbors, their sisters. Another day laborer this morning in Puebla told me, in the state of Puebla, all the cities there are under fire as well, where there's either cars that are burnt on the road, trucks that are stopped and burned, buses that are stopped and burned. And so folks are feeling it. I'll cut it there because of time. And I just want to thank you, Dennis, and I just want to, as we're speaking, have people really call in 800-439-5732.
We have to hold off on that.
I just want to say how important it is that we're able to have these airwaves to report in what's happening live. So yeah, folks are feeling it here as well as in Mexico.
And the work that you're doing, I guess it's in a way, Francisco, the people that you represent very much believe in families and family life. And it seems that part of the program now is to destroy the family, to really crush the family and the spirit of family, kidnapping young children and taking them off to another country, putting their parents in jail. I mean, this reminds us all of what fascism looks like, and it's are kids going to school now? Are there programs taking place where the kids can learn at home or in places where they don't feel they're in danger, or that where they have to travel and risk being arrested?
That is all happening around the country. Here in the Bay Area, people have resorted to supporting each other, where folks take other people's children to school and pick them up so parents don't have to risk the situation. We have had the kidnappings here in the last few days in San Francisco and in the Bay Area. There seems to be more activity now happening from ICE, and things have been reported to different emergency response centers. But the support network is very strong, where people are having to support each other with things like taking care of the children, going to school. There's also a program that's being developed of actual adoption for guardianship. There's a Vermont has a good model where people are actually signing up to adopt a child for 18 months in case the parent is deported, or in case that they're captured and they're still waiting in detention, to be able to care for the children and make sure the state doesn't take the child who's unaccompanied. Like, for example, if a child is left at school because the parent was kidnapped between them, before getting to them, the school is in obligation to call the CPS, and that gets the child handed over to the state. So that's one of the programs that's developed now between people, where there's an actual adoption program for 18 months with the commitment. There's a whole training and a whole process that's developed where I, as the U.S. citizen, commit to adopting that child for 18 months while I help them reunite, the families reunite. But yes, it's very clear. It's almost like this action of the U.S. government, of the Trump administration, is reading the manuals for public torture that were developed at the School of the Americas, where you do public executions, public kidnappings, you do violent actions in the public to traumatize the public. And it's very much aimed at families as well, like you're saying, Dennis.
Again, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's our good brother, Francisco Herrera, who spends a lot of time working with families who are under threat, under danger of being broken up, of being arrested. It's a different world. By the way, I'm speaking with Francisco Herrera. Also joining us is Miguel Gavilan Molina. But Francisco, really, I have to say it this way. White people in this country there are two worlds, and those worlds now are particularly separate. The life of a brown person, of an undocumented person, has been turned upside down. And we are talking tens of thousands, millions of people who oftentimes do the hardest work that keep this country going. What's the dialogue like, Francisco, in terms of how people are feeling? Are people surprised to the level of the brutality? Are people thinking? Is the message, is the Trump message, stay the hell out of America? Is it being carried home? Are people afraid to come here?
The dialogue here in the United States is folks are seeing solidarity from European Americans. America, of course, is a continent of 38, 39 countries. And the migration has been a pattern that our people have lived for thousands of years. So the migration has maybe been slowed down a little bit. I think it has not stopped. It has not stopped because places like El Salvador, which only, of course, they have clean streets according to the new dictator Bukele, but people are still having to flee. In Mexico, the violence is still forcing people to flee. So the migration is not going to stop as it has never stopped in the last 23,000 years, right? So that's not stopping. Yes. But there is a level of surprise that the government is now moved to what they've promoted and they've developed in our countries, right? Dictatorial behavior, authoritarianism, torture, public executions, kidnappings at night, masked men without any warrant. So now what people are experiencing is what we experienced in our countries, right? So in that sense, it's very sad to see that what the U.S. financed and promoted in the Latin America, and really did to our people, black and brown folks here as well, but to see it at this level of public violence that's promoted by the Trump administration, and then, you know, in the news you see what's her name, the lady at the Bondi, denying and helping and you know, kind of just collaborating with the same violence. Yeah, so it is a disturbing and daunting experience to say, wow, well, here it is, you know, chickens coming home to roost. What they financed and did in Latin America, they're now doing here in our own country.
That's Francisco Herrera. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, KPFA, here in the Bay Area. Also joining us, I think, is our own Miguel Garvalan Molina. Miguel, are you there?
Absolutely, Dennis. And just to continue on what the points that Francisco was making, particularly, you know, that at this point as we're talking, there's been something like 50 billion dollars that has been allocated for new detention centers. And I'll tell you something, it's pretty insane. They are being built massively right now. From what I understand, there's like they're locating at five different states to build these massive detention centers. One of them is going to be like 1.3 million square feet outside of Phoenix. And that's like, what? That's like seven football fields, you know, run down a line. They plan to house up to 7,000 to 10,000 people. They're doing this everywhere. And it's like, you know, they're going to turn it into a moneymaker. They're going to hire people. We got jobs for you. You know, we're going to build these detention centers to hold people rather than to process a way to get them, you know, to become legal residents. And it's insane. But one thing that's disturbing is the ideology. You know, that there's this whole thing now that, you know, the so-called, you know, the madman in the White House, you know, pretending to be president. We don't have a president, as Francisco said. We have a dictator here, and a mafioso, a gangster who talks in crude, rude, vulgar, bully, threatens, and then prosecutes, you know, who he feels are against him. What can we do, Francisco? Yeah. How can we do the pushback?
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned power, that the fact is, of the matter, it's been so beautiful to see the power of people united, people organizing. Folks can still go to adoptacornersf@gmail.com, adoptacornersf@gmail.com, and there, it doesn't matter what city you're in, we can reroute you to to the correct area where you would like to participating in the activity of Dr. Corner at the Latino Task Force in San Francisco or the Immigrant Defense Committee in Oakland Bay Area through this email as well, drcornersf@gmail.org. You can connect in ways that you can support. And this is what has to continue to happen for us to come together and continue to organize and continue to work together. Thank you. I'm sorry, I've gone too long here, but it is beautiful to see the level of organizing that's going on in our communities.
Okay, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.